From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as Washington and Russia prepare to meet next week, our correspondent on the Hill talks to lawmakers about their priorities and concerns over the Ukrainian crisis.
These incidents bear all the hallmarks of an orchestrated campaign of incitement, separatism, and sabotage, aided and abetted by the Russian security services.
Also today, as the search zone for missing flight MH370 narrows, we talk to a Maryland company at the technological heart of the hunt for the passenger jet, and the so-called water witches who claim they're saving the wine industry of drought-hit California.
There's people that think I'm crazy, but the fact of the matter is I've done well over 100 wells in my lifetime. You know, how do you argue with that?
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of our latest news headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. An early morning stabbing rampage took place at a high school in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania. The suspect, a 16-year-old male student, is now in custody. 19 students were injured in the attack, in addition to a 60-year-old security guard who was hurt while attempting to subdue the suspect. No fatalities are reported, though some students suffered serious injuries and are being treated at a local hospital. The police chief said a student or staff member pulled the fire alarm when the attack began, which helped in getting the school evacuated. Murraysville Police Chief Thomas Seifeld said the assistant principal of Franklin Regional High School outside Pittsburgh helped get the student into custody. Chief Seifeld said quick action prevented more people from getting injured in the attack.
It's my opinion that today, you know, as unfortunate as it is, and again, you know, hearts go out to all the victims and their families, I think it could have been a lot worse if there was an immediate interaction that occurred. The fire alarm being pulled probably assisted with evacuating the school, and that was a good thing that that was done.
Tension continues to build over pro-Moscow protesters that have taken over government buildings in Ukraine. Ukraine's Interior Minister Arsen Avakov said that within 48 hours, the activists must join talks with the state, or they will face the use of force. The U.S. and NATO have accused Russia of using unrest in eastern Ukraine to further destabilize the country and say Moscow has brought around 40,000 Russian troops to the eastern Ukrainian border. But Russia insists there is no reason for concern, saying the troops are only participating in routine military exercises. The murder trial of South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius continued, with a grueling cross-examination that left the defendant emotional. Pistorius told the prosecutor that he had made a terrible mistake in killing girlfriend Reva Steenkamp after he mistook her for an intruder. He refused to look at a picture of his heavily wounded girlfriend when asked to by the prosecution, and he insists this is not a case of murder. Newly released data on the U.S. social insurance program Medicare reveals a small fraction of doctors are paid millions of dollars. An AP analysis of the data reveals just over 300 doctors make more than $3 million in Medicare government payouts. Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
The detailed data on payouts from the Medicare system shows that by far the highest paid doctors are ophthalmologists, with one eye specialist in Florida making almost $21 million from Medicare payments alone. The Associated Press found that of the 825,000 physicians, 344 get over $3 million. Medicare provides health insurance to those aged over 65 and to younger people with disabilities.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Japanese car giant Toyota has announced a recall of 6.4 million vehicles worldwide. The faulty cars have a variety of issues, including airbags not deploying and car seats moving out of place during crashes. It's the second largest recall in the company's history. The number of people in the African nation of Guinea thought to have been killed by the Ebola virus has passed 100. This is according to the United Nations World Health Organization, who say it's one of the toughest outbreaks they've ever had to deal with. William Denzelow reports from the UN in New York.
The first case of Ebola was reported last month, originating in the southern part of Guinea, and the virus has since spread into neighboring countries. The United Nations World Health Organization say it could take as long as 4 months to contain the outbreak, due largely to the porous borders between many West African nations. There is no known cure for the Ebola virus, which is spread by close contact.
The search for missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 has been reinvigorated after searchers relocated audible signals from the plane. Here's Arthur Stevens from Australia.
33 days after the Boeing 777 vanished from radars with 239 people on board, it was announced on Wednesday that two acoustic signals had been picked up from a 4.5 kilometre deep part of the Indian Ocean. While the signals were several kilometres apart, they were effectively redetections after a pair of signals were picked up in the same 1,300 square kilometre area by the same Australian ship over the weekend.
And US Republicans have blocked a bill supported by President Obama aimed at ensuring equal pay for men and women. Republicans said the Paycheck Fairness Act was a political ploy for Democrats during an election year. But supporters say there's clear evidence women still make only 77 cents to every dollar earned by men. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. With pro-Russian protesters seizing government buildings in several Ukrainian cities, the US government is debating how best to respond. In an attempt to break the deadlock over the crisis, Washington, the EU, Russia and Ukraine are now planning to come together next week, the first time all have met since Ukraine's bloody revolution and the subsequent annexation of Crimea. As the White House and State Department push for further economic sanctions on Russia and measures to support Ukraine's upcoming elections, our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein spoke to lawmakers about their priorities and concerns.
Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland from the U.S. State Department briefed senators Wednesday morning about the latest developments in the ongoing conflict with Russia and Ukraine.
This week's violent occupation of government buildings in Kharkiv, in Donetsk, and in Luhansk deepen our concern. Far from a spontaneous set of events, these incidents bear all the hallmarks of an orchestrated campaign of incitement, separatism, and sabotage of the Ukrainian state, aided and abetted by the Russian security services.
Calling the situation a wake-up call that puts at risk the decades of cooperation since the fall of the Soviet Union, Nuland recommended several steps the U.S. government should take. She admitted some of these steps, such as austerity measures cutting wages, pensions, and home heating subsidies, will require painful sacrifices from all Ukrainians.
This is primarily going to be directed in the areas of strengthening anti-corruption and enforcement efforts, revising public procurement legislation, again, in an anti-corruption direction, introducing agricultural and energy sector reforms that are badly needed, also going to rooting out corruption, improving transparency, and helping the Ukrainian people prepare for free, fair elections on May 25th.
Nuland praised Congress for passing sanctions on some Russian officials and businesses involved in the annexation of Crimea and the continued unrest in the region. She said both the State Department and Congress can expand and strengthen these measures if necessary.
The administration has different tiers of sanctions that are under consideration, depending on what Russia does. It's really in Russia's hands.
That's Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin, who chaired Wednesday's hearing. He's pushing for an expansion of the Magnitsky Act, which bars Russians accused of human rights violations from traveling to the U.S. or using U.S. banks.
Putin needs to know that there's a price to pay for his aggression.
Other lawmakers on both sides of the political divide are continuing to push the Obama administration to speed up the approval of port facilities to export natural gas drilled in the United States. Though the infrastructure would take years to complete, they insisted Wednesday that these exports would be a significant weapon in the fight against Russian aggression. But other Congress members, including Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse, are skeptical of these claims. He suggested instead that the U.S. send solar panels and wind turbines to patriotic Ukrainians.
I wanted to make sure that we're pushing renewables into the conversation because, frankly, we build a lot of that stuff. And if the purpose of the exercise here is to reduce Ukraine's energy dependence on Russia, going to an alternative fossil fuel is one way to do it. But reducing overall demand with renewables is another way to do it, and in the long run, probably a better way.
In March, the nation's leading environmental groups wrote to the president urging him not to expand natural gas exports, arguing that increased drilling and fracking on U.S. lands would endanger fresh water sources and prolong global dependence on fossil fuels. White House said he shares these concerns and has additional worries.
The more natural gas we export, the higher the domestic price becomes. And at the moment, we're getting significant economic benefit out of lower natural gas prices. So why we would want to interrupt or interfere with that is a hard thing for me to understand.
The U.S., European Union, Russia, and Ukraine are scheduled to meet next week to find a diplomatic solution to the conflict. The State Department's Nuland told lawmakers she does not have high expectations for these talks, but feels it's important to keep the door open. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And for more analysis on the evolving unrest and international response, I spoke to Bartosz Rydlinski, an expert on Eastern Europe and a visiting professor at Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University. I began by asking him what form of Western response Russia's European neighbours wanted to see.
Most political elites in Ukraine looking forward for huge support from both, from the NATO, European Union and the United States. And what Western one can propose Ukraine, it is for sure the strong economic support. Namely, Ukrainian economy is in the deep crisis, and there is a huge need to have huge financial support, especially when Russian Federation made a lot of sanctions towards Ukraine. And of course, in my opinion, army supplies. I'm not talking to send the troops, you know, to Ukraine, but also to send, like, the equipment, you know, they can use in potential conflict.
Right. You're talking about sanctions, you're talking about financial help, but there was another development yesterday, and that was Russian President Vladimir Putin suggesting that the state-controlled energy firm Gazprom should make Ukraine pay up front for its gas. What's he trying to achieve with this maneuver?
Namely, he's trying to destabilize the region. His aim is not only Crimea, it is not only the eastern Ukraine, it is whole Ukraine. Like, the main aim of his Euro-Asian strategy is to have the Ukraine on board. Mm-hmm. So after, you know, like the Maidan, he decides to make the economy of the Ukraine, trying to make it as much as possible weak. This is his tool he used for many years. He used to the Baltic states, he used to Poland, he used also to Belarus. It is interesting that he used gas price as a political weapon in his personal fight towards West.
The EU, Russia, the United States and Ukraine, Bartosz, are expected to meet next week. And this will be the first four-way meeting of this kind since this crisis erupted. Do you think this meeting will break the current impasse?
No, in my opinion, absolutely not, for a very simple reason. Like, the Russian side trying to show all partners that they would like to influence the sovereign country policy as Ukraine. And both United States, European Union, and Ukraine cannot accept such root proposal and situation. Namely, John Kerry, he said in Paris, we will not talk about Ukraine without Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. And probably this is the line which Ukraine, European Union, and United States should follow.
Bartosz, finally, can I ask you, what do you think? You obviously talk to a lot of scholars and experts about this region and about this particular crisis. What do you think Vladimir Putin's game plan here is, ultimately?
He will not stop in Crimea. He already said that the Transnistria, that Ukrainian western side and southern, there are a lot of Russians as well in Estonia and Latvia, and that he would like to protect, you know, like the Russian speakers minorities there. So I think, like, he already said that Russia don't want to join the West anymore. He proposed another, let's say, proposal, another system, you know, towards West. He said, we are not the part of the Western community. We don't accept your values, and we are only like the true anti-modernization country, which also support the traditional values. European Union and the United States must accept that they are not partners anymore. You know, like the partners don't attack another country. And they've done it in Georgia. They've done it in Ukraine, in Crimea. So probably in few next years, we will see more and more, you know, like I said, problematic relation between Russia and the European Union and the United States.
Bartosz Rydlinski, an expert on Eastern Europe and a visiting professor at Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University. This is FSN Reports.
On Monday, I advised that the towed Pinger locator deployed by the Ocean Shield had detected signals consistent with those emitted by aircraft black boxes on two separate occasions. I can now tell you that Ocean Shield has been able to reacquire the signals on two more occasions.
Retired Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston, the search team leader for missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370, added that the data from the signals was consistent with pings from a flight data recorder. Houston says he hopes it will only be a matter of days before something can be recovered from the Indian Ocean floor that will confirm the location of the missing plane. 9 military aircraft and 14 ships are scouring the vast area in an attempt to locate the Boeing 777 before the plane's black box batteries run out. The plane dropped from radar en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing over a month ago. 239 passengers and crew were on board. Jim Gibson from Phoenix International in Maryland, the company that makes the submersible the US Navy is using in the search, explained what form this high-tech hunt was now taking.
We are currently underway conducting search operations on board the Ocean Shield. We're utilizing the US Navy's Towed Pinger Locator 25 system. This is a system that was designed and built by Phoenix International. It has a depth capability of approximately 6,000 meters, and it's designed to listen for a pinger, typically that you would see or find on a black aircraft black box. We also have on board the Ocean Shield the Phoenix International Artemis Autonomous Underwater Vehicle, or AUV.
Can you give us an idea of some of the challenges of searching that particular part of ocean?
Well, I think the challenge is just with respect to the depth of water. We're operating in approximately 4,500 meters of water, and that in itself, adds a degree of complexity and challenge. You have the logistics involved. You know, you're a distance. You know, I don't know whether it's 850,000 nautical miles or so from off the west coast of Australia. So you're not, it's not close. You've got several days transit to get out to the location. Whenever you're at sea, regardless of the area of the world, you have to contend with conditions, weather, fronts that are moving through. So you've got conditions that oftentimes challenge your ability to be able to launch and recover underwater systems.
Jim, can you just tell us, has this equipment that you've been describing, has it been used successfully for similar aviation incidents in the past?
Yes, actually, it's been used to locate and recover a number of military aircraft as well as a number of commercial aircraft. The autonomous underwater vehicle, Artemis, as we call it, was used last year for the search and subsequent recovery of an Air Force F-15 that crashed off of Okinawa. And the Towed Pinger Locator, of course, has been used successfully on a number of like I said, both commercial and military aircraft searches.
Is there any way of knowing, now that we have an approximate idea of the size of this search area, this search field, any idea of knowing how long it could possibly take, given the equipment and the technology being incorporated? and combing that region?
This is not an operation that is going to be over in a few days or possibly even in a few weeks. I think this is something that people need to understand and have a commitment, with an understanding that this is going to be a long-term effort. I can't really give you an honest assessment in terms of numbers of weeks, numbers of months, but we're certainly doing the best we can, and again, remain very optimistic in our ability to find the wreckage and recover it.
Jim Gibson from Phoenix International in Maryland. Now, concern appears to be growing in the US over Chinese chicken. The Department of Agriculture's decision to allow China to process US chicken and send it back to America has opponents intensifying their efforts to keep the offending items out of school nutrition programs. A Capitol Hill briefing this week saw panelists, including food bloggers and nutrition specialists, criticise the USDA's decision, accusing it of putting profit before food safety. A petition to oppose Chinese poultry imports has already been backed by over 300,000 signatures. For more on this Chinese chicken controversy, I spoke to Tony Corbo from Food and Water Watch.
This goes back to 2005 when the United States Department of Agriculture proposed a rule that would allow China to ship processed poultry to the United States, provided that the raw poultry came from an approved source. And at the time, the only two approved sources were the United States and Canada. USDA finalized the regulation in April of 2006, but then Congress intervened because of the checkered food safety safety track record in China. And for a couple of years, there was actually legislation that prevented the United States Department of Agriculture from proceeding. And then the People's Republic of China filed a World Trade Organization complaint against the United States and was successful. And so USDA started its review of the Chinese food safety system after that WTO decision, and in August of 2013 announced that they had reaffirmed their 2006 decision to allow China to ship processed poultry to the United States.
Why are we talking about this now? Why has the issue come up again?
China is very close to certifying at least four poultry processing plants to export processed poultry to the United States. The action is very imminent. And so a group of members of Congress have written a letter trying to put a provision in the upcoming budget bill for USDA to put restrictions on the importation of poultry products from China. And so this morning there was a congressional briefing, where congressional staff from other offices could learn about the issue.
So what is so troubling for your organization about processed chicken from China? Chicken seems to be more popular than ever in the United States. So isn't this a case of supply and demand?
We only import about 5% of the chicken that's consumed in this country. The primary sources of raw poultry comes from either Canada or now Chile. Chile was allowed to export their processed their poultry products to the United States in 2007. So we're pretty self-sufficient in terms of poultry production in this country. The underlying reason for this decision on China is the fact that China stopped importing beef from the United States in 2003 when there was a cow diagnosed with mad cow disease here in this country, and China stopped importing our beef after that. So this is a quid pro quo.
So if a family, a parent here in the United States prepares their kid's lunchbox for the day, a chicken salad sandwich, and let's say for argument's sake, that chicken was chicken processed and sent to the United States from China. Why should you be worried? Why should that parent be concerned about what their child is consuming?
we won't have any USDA inspectors stationed in these processing plants in China to verify that what we're getting back is cooked poultry of U.S. origin. So it could, you could very well have Chinese poultry coming to the United States that would violate the regulation and the restrictions.
So what would you like to see happen next?
We would like the USDA to stop the process here until there are assurances that the food safety system in China is indeed equivalent. I mean, we still hear of major scandals in China where, you know, rat meat has been disguised to look like mutton. And you have the instances of intentional contamination of milk with melamine, and then the illegal use of antibiotics that are not supposed to be used in animal husbandry, and there are cases in China where that's been discovered. You know, one of the things that we do import from China as a poultry product is pet food, and the Food and Drug Administration is now investigating why 3,000 dogs have gotten sick and 580 have died from eating chicken and duck jerky treats manufactured in China.
Tony Corbo from Food and Water Watch. Now, despite some recent rain, California is still in the grip of one of its worst droughts on record. There are worries that the Golden State's wine industry will take a hit this year as vines struggle to grow in the dry conditions. Some viticulturalists have hired dowsers, known as water witches, to help them find underground streams on their land, a practice that skeptics say has no foundation in science. Our correspondent Rebecca Bowring has been to the Napa Valley to find out more about the ancient craft.
Rods, which direction is the water flowing? Is there water 500 feet, 490, 480?
Mark Mondavi belongs to a legendary winemaking dynasty. He's also a dowser or water witch.
Is there 50 gallons a minute? Is there 60 gallons a minute?
The Mondavi family's been growing grapes in the Napa Valley since the mid-20th century. But these days water is in short supply, meaning vines are bearing up to a quarter less fruit. Mondavi believes that by using copper divining rods and his natural energy, he can find water hidden deep underground. He asks the rods questions, and when they cross, the answer is yes. Skeptics say the practice is pure superstition, but Mondavi argues that his track record shows it works.
There's people that think I'm crazy, but the fact of the matter is I've done well over 100 wells in my lifetime, and I've gotten some of the biggest wells in an area. So, you know, how do you argue with that?
As the drought has deepened, Mondavi's phone's been ringing off the hook. He charges $500 a visit and could earn $20,000 to $30,000 from dowsing this year. One happy customer is the Rombauer Vineyard.
The tank itself, I think, grand total, footing, excavations, tank was $100,000.
They have a tank storing well water from a source over 600 feet down that was discovered by Mondavi. Jim Davis is facilities manager at Rombauer Vineyards.
No matter what people say, they may think it's a bunch of witch doctor voodoo stuff, but it truly works. Sometimes you're looking for power lines. Sometimes you're looking for a wastewater line. But there's something that you have that's energy that flows, and it's able to detect stuff if you know the right questions to ask.
The U.S. Geological Survey's opinion is that dowsers tend just to be lucky. The natural explanation of successful water dowsing, it said in a report, is that in many areas water would be hard to miss. That assessment doesn't bother Mark Mondavi. He's so proud of the ancient craft that he's even named a special wine label after it.
We're really excited about the wines again.
Defining Rod Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon is on sale across the United States and being exported to Canada. Local wine buffs appreciate the fruits of his labour.
Cheers to the Defining Rod.
Cheers.
It's not just natural, it's supernatural, says Mondavi, who plans to continue using a little magic to turn water into wine. Rebecca Bowring, Napa Valley, California.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Thursday, we're in Florida to get the reaction of space industry veterans to NASA's move to sever ties with Russia. That's Thursday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.